You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and our guest on this segment is Ed Feldman. However, due to a recording difficulty, we missed about the first minute or minute and a half of the interview, so we're going to cut into that partway in, but please do go ahead and enjoy this interview. Thank you.
Wild edibles and hang out with my dogs, and that's fun. I'm an upstater, so been in the area for all of it, for the most part. And like I said, country boy. But I'm, my brothers call me an educated redneck. So like I do all the country things.
Right.
But the country boys do. But
you don't have the same politics.
Or
part of the same politics.
Possibly true with at least one of them. But I like art. So that makes me weird. Like they don't. I'm the only one in my family to go to college. I'm the only one to get a master's degree. I chose art, of course.
Sure.
There's, you know, it's very, you can become rich really quick with that.
Well, you know, I mean, if you're working in agriculture, you're working kind of at the, unless you happen to have a lot of capital investment that's paying off, you are, you know, working very close to poverty levels.
Indeed.
But so why shouldn't you be an artist?
It all made sense to me, and pottery specifically, like, you get down and dirty with it. It's something you share with people. And it's, I think I ended up, pots kind of came to me rather than me finding pots, if that makes sense.
How so? Yeah.
In high school, I had this great art teacher and she brought in this potter. And I took to throwing pots like a duck to water pretty quick. Like I really enjoyed it. And I rather than learn to make a cup or a mug or like a bowl or something, my idea was I'll make mom a dinnerware set for Thanksgiving, and I did. It's a bunch of real giant paperweights is what it amounts to,
but I
did it all, like gravy boat, the whole nine.
Wow.
And I ended up going to college. I wanted to be an archaeologist, anthropologist, and then I found the art department at an art opening I showed up at, and the professors were great, and the pretty girls were there, and they're all hanging out and having fun, and it's like they weren't as uptight is the archaeology department professors.
Sure.
And I was like, oh, yeah, they've got pottery. And I took the pottery class. And I ended up meeting John Jesman, and became my mentor and a lifelong friendship to this day. And I'm probably closer to him than I am most of my blood relatives.
Sure.
Just a profound influence on me.
Sure.
And it's, because of him, I'm do this now, you know?
Yeah.
And he's a character. He's kind of the same. He grew up poor on a farm and first went to college and ended up in the arts. So there was a lot of understanding of each other at a pretty basic level. Like we just kind of viewed the world the same. Very, very liberal.
Right.
But a lot of manual labor, hard work, and just getting to it, you know?
Right, like, right. The grunt ethic.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, my parents really instilled that in us early on. We're all in it together, and you just work until the job is done. There's no whining. Right. You just go.
No slacking off, and you know when it's done, you'll have fun.
Sometimes,
if you don't have fun while you're doing it.
I remember being a kid, and my little brother and I were told we were going to go on a vacation, and we're like, oh. A vacation?
We do vacations?
Yeah, like that, we'd never heard of this notion, right? And we're thinking like we'd seen on TV on one of the three channels that vacation was going to Disney World. So we somehow got it in our head we're going to Disney World, right? And we're telling our friends and we're getting ready for this. And vacation consisted of camping in a tent and splitting firewood for the winter setup. So we spent a week chopping firewood.
Right, for your vacation.
And we were not happy about this for the first few hours, but it ended up being like one of the best things ever. Like we were picking berries and swimming in a pond. And so there was some downtime that was fun. I think it was one of the first times we got to actually hang with our dad because he worked like 80 hours a week for 30 years. I mean, the man was just a machine.
Right. And right.
He took time to go have some fun, which was just, it was unheard of, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Dad giggling was like, wow, that's strange.
he is capable of it.
Yes.
Yeah. And, it's funny. I was reading a piece in the newspaper this week. One of the differences between rural people and urban people historically is that they work so hard. And this 80-hour kind of, you never stop until it's done. You don't think anything about, and you may actually end your paying work and do another 6 hours of volunteer work.
Yep.
I mean, it's just kind of the way life is lived. And that doesn't really compute for a lot of urban folk.
Yep. I married a gal from the city, and we have jokes about that.
And I, too, am partnered. I grew up on a subsistence farm in North Missouri, so I was invited to go to art institute in Kansas City, but I couldn't figure out how one could make a living doing art. And I had older siblings who went to college, so that seemed a more viable path for me. But I wonder what it would have been like had I've actually taken my art teacher's advice and gone there.
It dawns on me. I never thought, like, I'm going to go to college to become something, like,
right,
or to get a career, a job. I was like, oh, I get to go study the things I'm interested in?
That's right.
Because I was a horrible student in high school, like a bottom third of my class.
Yeah, yeah.
In college, I did great, you know?
Well, you had the internal motivation.
I did. And I think all of my life can really be framed with the luck, chance, and failure. Like, so my brothers have a saying that Ed's so lucky he could fall in a bucket of shit and come out smelling like a rose.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And they begrudgingly say that at times.
Right, right.
Which is fine. Like, I understand sibling jealousies and whatnot. Like, I certainly have mine about them.
How many siblings do you have?
There's five of us all told.
Wow. Wow.
And there's a 10-year gap between me and the next oldest. And my parents had a joke that dad was showing off, or what was the other one? There was no heat that week or something.
Right, right.
Corny Catholic folks.
Yes, 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 yes. You brought some music with you.
Yes, sir.
We're going to start with a tune, Needle and Thread, by Pert Near Sandstone.
Yes.
Do you want to say anything about that or just play it?
Just go ahead and play. It's a great song.
Here we
love
go.
Love this band.
Thank you.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Ed Feldman. So, Ed, given the life that you value now, given the way you live now, what did you have to learn? What did you have to go through in order to know how to live it?
A lot of how I've got to this spot in my life has been a lot of luck, I think, and chance. People don't necessarily think how much of that actually happens in their life.
Sure.
But I think with luck and chance and there's kind of a family thing that, I'm really lucky. And I think it's things present themselves and you got to be willing to take a shot and fail. And I think with luck and chance and being lucky, there's so much failure. Like I have just really messed up countless times.
Sure.
In little ways and in huge ways. But I think it's the get back up and give it another swing or regroup or no one to call it quits on something is often a difficult thing.
Right.
But I think, some of the biggest failures in my life ended up being some of the best things that have happened to me.
Right. How did you learn? Okay. So when you said luck and chance, that without the failure piece behind it, it comes like, well, you just kind of walk through life and luck and chance will get you through. But that's not what it's about. What it's about is being able to deal with what you've been dealt.
Yeah.
To respond to it, to work with it. And then you said to fail. When did you learn to accept that failure is just part of the process? What did you have to fail at?
Probably last week.
In order to begin to see that it ain't pretty, but it works.
That's an ongoing thing, frankly. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really is in the last few years where I've really started to realize like, maybe it's not all. I guess I failed miserably. Like the one big one that really put me here right now in this place.
Right.
Was I got divorced. I wasn't doing well in a marriage and I bailed on this poor woman and my kids. Like it was a horrible thing to do, but we were miserable together.
Right.
And not like bad, like wasn't fighting or mean, but,
you were just deeply unhappy.
Well, we got married because we were pregnant and it was what you did, you know?
Right.
And I was truly head over heels in love with this woman. And, I think the poor gal was in a position where she was pregnant and didn't know what to do. And I guess we're going to do this. That's how I think. I don't know for certain.
Right.
We had these two like amazing kids. Like Eric and Nika are just like the best thing going and they're amazing human beings now.
Mm-hmm.
And to their mom's credit, you know, she did a lovely, amazing job raising them. She was a great mom and is a great mom.
Mm-hmm.
So I beat myself up over having been like so horrible humanist to have done that. And I think it took
some
time.
So what did you learn from beating yourself up?
Well, that over time, you know, we all moved on and she found things in her life that made her happy. And I got to go make art and follow that passion of being a potter. And in the end of the whole thing, like, she's found a nice life. My kids are happy and healthy. You know, we both work to have a relationship and
sure.
be, you know, get along and do nice things with the kids. And I was a little bumpy, you know, but it wasn't a horrible thing.
Right.
And I met my now, the woman I'm married to now. And, I met her in the city and I stopped. I was bartending and stuff and kind of being an ass and went to the city to get a proper job. I used to bartend here at Simeon's way back in the day. And I moved down to the city on a whim and got like an office job and a shirt and tie and did the professional thing. And this gal I met there said, hey, you know, you really like making pots. Why don't you go pursue that? And I was like, oh, okay. So I ended up getting into grad school at SU in my late 30s and got my MFA and been making pots ever since. And it's been great, you know. And got to redo a relationship with my kids as more adults.
Right.
And that's been weird, but lovely, you know, and to see them now, my daughter's married and is, expecting the second grandkid. And, it's amazing to see her as a mom. She's, she's a strong woman. She's pretty good stuff. And, she's really happy.
Right.
And that just fills me with joy. So.
And what's important to me and from the point of view of this show is that, you know, these are awkward things.
Yeah.
And failure is awkward and it's not easy to talk about. But it also is that you came out on the other side with a relationship that it was something wasn't sufferable beyond. And to get out of that, you almost had to become more unsufferable to yourself.
I think one of the things is you got to learn to forgive yourself for screwing up. And I was a kid, you know.
In college?
Yeah. Yeah, when all this happened. And yeah, I'm probably haven't forgiven myself, but.
right.
You know.
So
day by day.
What was interesting about the way you brought this up is you also said it's a continuous thing.
Yeah.
And how do you experience it now? Routinely?
I think it's just I can show by example. Because you can say you're sorry to you blew in the face, and that doesn't mean anything really. Unless you show that, you know, you're trying to be a better person.
Some change is in place or some regard for the other person or
some
direct act of kindness or
and I think, consideration. You know, I was just flailing in the dark, not having any idea what the hell I was doing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, just trying to be a better person.
Mm-hmm.
And that, yeah, you screw up and you fail people, but you can try desperately as best you can. And I think it's, if you've got any conscience or any soul at all, you make an effort to try and right your wrongs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Right. So, but I got a sense that your current spouse, she invited you to follow your love.
Yeah.
And what was different about that for you?
Well, she really believed in the idea that don't worry about money or like all the other things that you are often supposed to worry about. So you should be concerned about them, but you know, you only get to ride the roller coaster the once, as far as we know.
Sure.
And, you know, it's a lot more fun to throw your hands in the air and giggle while you're screaming over the top. And she's like the happiest person going. You will never see that woman not smiling and cracking jokes and enjoying life.
And she's living that way herself.
Yeah. Like, everything about her is that she is full of joy.
Mm-hmm.
And she's my best friend. I think that was the other thing I learned about relationships is there's like the being goofy in love. And then there's a deeper love and an understanding of a person being a separate entity and you being you. And then together you're a stronger team.
Right.
And yeah, she has taught me to be a good teammate.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, she's kind of always on me to, hey, you're not a horrible person. Like, you know, you give yourself a little bit of a break. And so that's been good. That's helped.
Right. So, how is it that you came to be so aware of the darker side, the less flattering side of life and of yourself? How is that something that's always come natural to you or
no, like most things I stumble through.
Uh-huh.
I think the fool card in the tarot deck is like my spirit animal, if you will. that should be a big tattoo on my back, because I do kind of blindly bumble along at some that really is true. And well, I bumbled into drinking really, really hard, and it realized I just kind of pissed my life away. And I was like, that is not how I want to live.
Mm-hmm.
And I got myself cleaned up and got back up and made another go at trying to be a decent human being.
And so how old were you when that, was that with the divorce or?
Yeah. I was in late 20s.
Right.
So, but yeah. I seen, you can let yourself become a dark, miserable person.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes a little bit of work too, I suppose. And I just seen that I seen myself going down this path and I was like, this is not how my life is supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And that's so, when you moved to New York or did you?
I got cleaned up and I think it was Alpha House. It was an outpatient program.
Sure.
But yeah, I got my stuff together and moved down to New York and met stuff. And yeah, it was just, life was good again. Like, I found some reason to be happy and, spent a lot of time back and forth to see the kids and to do things. And it took some time to put the pieces back together and, you know, smooth them down and try and make another go of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry.
I guess what I'm curious about is how does this deep awareness of both sorrow and regret, but also joy and wonder and this, you know, throwing pots and foraging for food and being outdoors. How does this emotional and visceral approach to life help make peace for you through your work?
I think if I can just shut the little monkey brain off for a moment every so often, that's a big win for me.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's, as of late, that's my big concern.
And how do you shut that? What happens? How do you know you've shut that monkey brain off?
Ooh, I'm not convinced I ever really succeed.
Well, no, but I mean, is it to the side that you are? Is it that you're immersed in the bliss of doing something? Is it that you?
Often, yeah, it's just getting caught up in what they call a flow state, right?
Like, mm-hmm.
And I can find that in different places, and every so often it's just enough to be like, oh.
Where do you find it?
In my studio often, but in weird places. Like you can just be walking down the street and be like, oh, hey, you know, I notice that there's not the perpetual noise in my head.
Right.
And,
so what is present? What are you with? When the noise is not in your head,
I'm not. It's the feeling a little bit more connected. You know, I don't know really.
With the moment, with where you are.
Yeah.
Whatever you're doing.
Yeah, there's no. You're not swimming in your head about the past. You're not in an anxious state thinking about what could
right.
maybe.
You're fully present and accounted for.
Yeah, just watching and paying attention to how lovely things can actually be.
Yeah. Let's cut to music. What should we play next?
Go with the Heart with No Companion. Okay. Leonard got me through a lot of things in life.
Do you want to say something about it, this one?
I'll tell you, more Leonard Cohen. I was introduced to Leonard Cohen when I was on Cape Cod by this gal, Deirdre Hall. And I didn't have a CD player, but I bought the CD and then saved up to buy the CD player. I liked it so much.
Uh-huh.
But yeah.
Here we go.
Now I greet you from the other side of sorrow and despair, with a love so vast and shattered, it will reach you everywhere. And I sing this for the captain whose ship has not been built, for the mother incarnate through the nights of wild distress. Though your promise count for nothing, you must keep it nonetheless. You must keep it for the captain whose ship has not been the mother in confusion, her cradle still unfilled. For the heart with no companion, for the soul without a king, for the prima ballerina who cannot side of sorrow and despair, with a love so vast and shattered, it will reach you everywhere.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this episode is Ed Feldman. So, Ed, part of the timing of this is you're being a potter. You're part of a group that's doing the Finger Lakes Pottery Tour.
Yes, yes, indeed.
And I'd like to just hear a little about who are the potters involved in that, and what is it about?
It's a group. I'm going to mess up the number here. I think there's 8 of us now. Julie Crosby started this whole thing. These pottery tours have become kind of popular. When you go to craft fairs, they always try and have like a potter next to a jeweler, mm-hmm. next to a printmaker. And the idea that, you know, you're not going to sell, like somebody that buys somebody else's pot didn't buy one of mine.
Right.
And these tours have happened, and it kind of proves that that's not true. We all do better when we all do better, right? Like,
right.
If by sharing our resources and our efforts, everybody kind of moves along, right? And so, in any case,
it's a little bit. I mean, it's the pottery version of the art trail.
Yes, 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 yes.
Yeah.
So Julie Crosby went out of her way. Like she, the woman's a machine. She put this together, and last year was our first year. It was a huge success. There's three studio spaces that you can mm-hmm. go to. And we bring in guest artists. So there'll be, I think, 8 or so artists that every year will change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it'll bring something new to the table, and that'll kind of rotate through. And it's been a good lesson in community for me.
How so?
Well, you know, I sit in my studio at my house and knock my pots out and make my work and send it off to do or go to shows and stuff. And I don't interact much with the community. And that's something they really need to work on, mm-hmm. you know. And I have been over the past year. And a lot of that I kind of owed it to Julie for making me think about things in that kind of framework, mm-hmm. you know. And so yeah, hats off to her. And
so how does being more attentive to the community of potters in your life make a difference for you?
Pottery's a tough go, like depending on how you're firing. There's just a lot of manual labor involved in it,
mm-hmm.
and there's always problems. You're out of grizzly borate or some chemical that you need. You know, hey, can I borrow like a cup of that because I got to make this glaze for the show that's in, you know, 36 hours, and I've still got to fire the kiln.
Right.
So there's that end of it, and there's the questions, and this is a business that there's no real blueprint for. It's not like you go to school and you learn ABC and, you know, you're done. There's all these different ways to approach it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard when you're making things that are not straightforward and simple pots that people can get their head around. It's like you talk to people about galleries, to how do we find good gallery representation, which ones are good to work with. Mm-hmm. And it's a very tight-knit community that really does go out of its way to help everybody in it. It's great. And you can have those discussions about like, oh man, I'm having these problems with this form and I don't feel it. Like, what do you think? Like, how could I make this better? Or, folks will come to your studio and talk about it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And oftentimes it's like technical stuff, but other things are it's aesthetics and helping you figure out why it is you think the way you think just by having a little talk.
How beauty or functionality works for you.
Right, right. And I know how I look at things, but getting somebody else that's, I respect their opinion and they've got an understanding of the medium, to have them be critical is a good thing, and really needed. And it's sometimes kind of hard to find, and especially if you're just sitting in your studio by yourself.
Right. One of the other hats that I wear is I facilitate groups for people who are involved in creative endeavors, artists, writers, people going through major life transitions. And what we've found is they can, regardless of what your transition or your creative activity is, you have a lot to learn from other people, especially if they're not going through the same thing you're going through.
Sure.
And you also have a lot to give. But we don't often create the space where you can share that critical but also considerate reaction or put out a question, put out something for others to respond to, because we just don't think about creating those spaces very much.
Indeed.
So how have you had to change over the years in ways that you wouldn't have chosen, but that has proved to be helpful? Is that a question that resonates for you? Because there are other ways I could ask it. How has life surprised you and turned out differently than you thought it would?
Oh, I really didn't think I'd end up at 50 years old making pots. I wasn't even sure I'd make it to 50, frankly, for a good chunk of my life.
Right. I mean, but, when you're at the bottom of a bottle.
Life's a little weird.
Right. So you're kind of amused by that and pleased by that.
Oh, I'm tickled pink, man. Like, the other side of that doesn't seem like a lot of fun,
Right. But there's a whole bunch of questions that I want to ask, and I don't know quite how to frame them. You're one of five kids. Mm. You're kind of the artist in the family, when you tell me you're from rural America, and my being from rural America, and I was the dreamer or the artist among my siblings, in some funny sort, and there are seven of us, and there's a way in which it's easy to get dragged down into your just kind of knowledge of the complexity of it all, and right. the possible futility of it all. And yet to be able to also know the wonder of it, and to kind of be able to tread in both of those spaces, because both of them produce really wonderful insights.
Sure.
Painful in their own way.
I was fortunate as a kid to my best friend from 5 years old to now, Mateo Davis, his parents, were antique dealers, and, you go to their house and it's filled with these strange things that I'd never seen before. And they're talking about Hudson River Valley furniture and Bobek chairs. And, there's these tapestries. And his mom was from Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And
hence the name Mateo.
Mateo, yeah. And so they're bilingual in the house and they're eating these weird foods I'd never seen, right?
Uh-huh.
And I was just blown away by, this is just great. It's not shut up, eat your food, and get back to work. My parents were that militant about it, but
there wasn't
candlelight dinners, right? That wasn't an option.
Right. But it doesn't sound like you were asking for candlelight. You might've been asking, could we have a moment of wonder here? Like, Dad, could you laugh or giggle?
Yeah, he did. But yeah. I think, they were just engaged in something so different from what I was used to seeing. And it was like my first exposure to that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Carmen really was after me. Eddie, you're going to go to college. You need to go to college. You need to learn. You need to see these things. Mm-hmm. And Carmen really is like my other mom. My mom had passed by the time I got married the second time here. And Carmen came from Mexico to dance with me as for the mom dance. And just the most lovely woman. And her husband, Jerry, was great. they exposed me to all these things. And I'm sorry, I've lost track on this.
Let me just say something and you'll gather the thought. One of the things that you grew up in rural America in upstate New York, or where in upstate New York?
Unadilla Forks, not Unadilla. Sidewalks. No, and it was
when Unadilla. And not far from the Unadilla Silo Company.
Correct.
I have a visual sense of that area, not necessarily Unadilla Forks, but Unadilla. One of the things that in almost every rural place that I've ever known, there's just a cast of characters of people who, quote, don't fit. You know, and we depend upon those folks. You know, and that's, and life is interesting, and the whole place, in many ways, this lily white rural America oftentimes has more diversity than the culturally diverse cities where people don't really see each other's quirkiness because they're segregated into separate spaces, or they only see it in passing. You got to go into the house.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And be, and just hang with these folks who are very different. I could have found, you know, I could walk past 50 houses in the place where I grew up, and I could point out 20 or 30 of the quirkiest things on earth about those places because they were just quirky people.
Right. It's because of those, and they were quirky, but in a kind of elegant way.
Yeah. They brought a touch of class.
And that exposure and their sharing things with me and pushing me and helping. Like Mateo and I got to go spend a summer on Cape Cod to save money for college because Jerry was kind enough to cut a check to give us enough to get a place to stay.
Like, right.
I didn't have that kind of money, you know. Like I was saving bottles and cans and working full time to go to college.
Sure, sure.
So yeah, they really did an awful lot. Again, I had a professor, David McDonald at Syracuse. One of the reasons I went there was to study with this man. And and David said, we get places in life because somebody's willing to bend and let us crawl up on their back and help raise us up so right. we can have a chance at doing a little better.
Right.
And you know, it's, as I look back, my parents really thought that way. Like you help everyone, you just try.
Right. And part of that may be why they worked so hard.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think I painted them in this weird picture that they're bumpkins.
That's not what I heard. What I heard was kind of hard workers and somewhat driven.
But in you do that because somebody else is bad off and you need to help them.
Right.
You know?
Right. You're driven my not parents, for your own welfare, but you're driven for the welfare of the whole.
The community, yeah. And that's... going back to that, right? Like my mom's garden fed countless households, and she would go to these auctions and buy boxes of strange things because there was a shirt in there she needed, but hey, I know there's like six other things in there that poor little kid down the street doesn't have and could use, and I'll make sure that they get them.
Right.
You know, and my parents, they have two nickels to rub together and they're giving stuff away to help somebody.
Right. And that's the way community as opposed to society works.
Yeah. And so the pottery tour thing is sharing our works with other folks. And I'm just trying to think how to frame this. Like, it's to the notion of community. It's helped me realize that I need to make more efforts. And to that end, I am. Trying right now in the middle of a project to try and develop a clay thing in Cortland. So we'll see how that goes. This year has been going great. towards that. I'm hoping to
have like a, like a teaching space or
Something for the community, for parents that want to have a break from the house and go make some pots and find some quiet meditative practice, or to little kids who don't have an art program because the budget's been cut, and give them a chance to play in mud and
express themselves. Is it a little like the clay school in Ithaca?
Yes, and Julie Dean's part of the Finger Lakes Pottery Tour, and I've gone to her countless times to pick her brain about how do I go about this, and she's been a wealth of knowledge.
Yeah, and I just want to, before we move on to the next piece of music, and
please.
This is the FingerLakesPotteryTour.com, and the Pottery Tour happens the weekend of May 11 and 12. That's Mother's Day Sunday weekend.
Yep.
So it's FingerLakesPotteryTour.com, all is one word.
Yep. We're on Instagram and Facebook also.
Yeah, and you can go and see the work of, what, 8-10 different potters.
Oh, more.
More than, okay.
And there will be demos.
Demos by 8. Yeah.
And it's a full day's event, if you like. And there'll be things to eat, and it's a nice experience.
Cool. So you brought an Iggy Pop piece, The Passenger. Shall we play that now?
Yes, please.
Okay, here we go. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report. Our guest on this hour is Ed Feldman. So, Ed, the way we close the show out is with a question about self-care. And for some of us, I kind of learned that it was my responsibility to take care of myself kind of late in life, even though I've been taking care of everybody else. I started working to help support my family when I was 11, but I didn't really get clear of the memo about the self-care piece. But also, what is it that you do to take care of yourself physically, emotionally, intellectually? And for me, those three add up to spiritually.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the day, daily, weekly, monthly, throughout the year, what do you do to kind of take care of yourself, and how do you know you need to do it?
Yeah.
And sometimes how you know, how do you know you need to do it? Maybe the entry point.
I used to be like uber healthy when I was a kid. I competed in gymnastics of all things. And yeah, I was very healthy, but then I learned to not be healthy for a while, and but I was young, so I bounced right back.
Right.
And then I got to my 40s, and the bounce back was a much longer process.
Right.
And yeah, so my wife is an avid runner. She ran the New York City Marathon, and she's just a little savage. You know, she runs for miles and then comes home and wings a kettlebell around for half an hour. And I do not.
Right.
I've tried a couple of times to run. I have a saying that, you know, I'll run when I'm out of bullets, but right. It's but yeah, so I've got this great life and a lovely wife and grandkids, and I want to be around to enjoy it. And so I joined a gym that I begrudgingly at times go to. It's not super consistent, but mm-hmm. I'm making an effort. Heard a thing on NPR about doing a 30-day challenge thing, like checking it off on the calendar. So I've actually been doing that. Mm-hmm. And there's something about checking the little box off in the calendar. It sounds dopey, but it really works for me.
It helps, you know, keep you focused. I mean, I'm wondering, for you, the physical exercise piece, you're throwing pots, what, 5 days a week, 6 days a week,
seven days a week? Yeah.
And that's incredibly physical. So that's going to keep the aerobic work. Your heart rate's going to be up because you're going to be really pushing it. You just need the other exercise to balance out what you're not getting, I would imagine, throwing pots.
Sort of. Well, you know, I drove this thing like a stolen rental car, so my body is pretty beat up. And so I do a lot of stuff now at the gym is more so I don't have to have surgeries, like my shoulders are torn. So in the making pots thing, I've learned to do it a little wiser. Mm-hmm. Throw standing up instead of sitting down hunched over. That solved a lot of my back problems. I have to do stretches now. So again, it's just a maintenance thing. It's like we got a little above ground pool a couple of years back, and I thought this was just going to be glorious. You know, it'd be sitting poolside. And I thought at one point in my life, oh, I get a little older, it's going to be great. I'll have everything figured out. And then you realize when you get there, that's like, no, it's a little bit of fun and a lot of maintenance. It's really just trying to hold it together one last season.
Right. Right.
But yeah, I suppose mind, body, spirit wise. So the body thing, I'm working on it. I'm not great at it, but you know, effort goes in and what happens, happens. I try to play with, we've got these two dogs and I try to run the hill with them and play with them. And that there's something weirdly calming about that. Mm-hmm. And it's doing something for something else or for somebody else. And they are little people, sort of, so to speak.
Right.
Ookie and Fatty Boom Boom are two dogs. I'm just trying to think. I find a lot of solace in throwing when I am making pots. Like that really does seem to help.
Mm-hmm.
And I find creating things is an optimistic endeavor. Like
right.
it you feel better. There's not only do you have a finished thing, but it's from concept in your head to physically putting it together and then having it there. And every so often I find little pots every so often, a little spot in a pot or a piece in total that I go like, yeah, okay, that embodies a feeling of not just like accomplishment, but there's a little piece of my life, so to speak, in it. I don't know if I'm really saying this right.
There's a little piece of me in there.
And this sounds weird, but I'm like sharing more than just that. I don't know how to, it's like the joy I felt making it,
mm-hmm.
that it shows in the form, and I kind of hope, and I have this little weird idea that when people use the pot, that happens for them.
Right, right.
That they feel that like somehow I've fused it in there.
So when they look at it, when they hold it, they will smile or they will laugh because it will inspire in them the kind of joy that you felt when you created it.
Yeah. The pots are great because they're art, right?
Right.
Like it's about form and, mm-hmm. and color and but then there's this functionality part to it. And we're creatures that need ceremony, whether we are religious or not.
Right.
I'm certainly not religious, but I really see the necessity in ceremony. Like, it just shows up, you know, you do it without realizing. People buy mugs from Walmart with, you know, Garfield on it, and that there's 1,000 of those cups, but the one that they use every morning, that's magically their cup. And then that's a ceremony, right?
Right.
And like, I like to talk to people about their coffee cups, because they start seeing that and start thinking about it. Maybe they'll want to buy a pot that'll help them have that ceremony.
Right.
People are drawn to things because of that, that ceremonial aspect with everything. Like, mm-hmm. the songs they have to listen to when they go to work or come back from, or...
What does the ceremony do for us? Why is ceremony important?
You know, I really have no idea why it is we do that. I think about it, and I don't know if it's a celebration.
How does it feel to you to think about it? Well, you said celebration.
Yeah, I think it's about celebrating. Nobody knows why we're here. You put meaning in this. Mm-hmm. So how you help yourself understand maybe why it is you're here. And I think that those ceremonies are mm-hmm. one way to do that.
Right. And what the way I would just tweak what you're saying a little bit is that the meaning or the ceremony gives it a sense of wholeness and completion.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows us to do it and make sense of it and then to walk away from it and do something else. It's like, you know, the rituals of saying hello and goodbye allow us to then to meet and part, and
so, we can, sure.
Yeah. And they define the beginning and end, and they make the time complete.
excuse me.
What do you do? I see the emotional, connection with that you put into the pots. You want the people who take and use them to feel those things too. I see them with the dogs. How do you make that? And you've talked about your wife, about the emotional connection there. Mm-hmm. How do you behold each other or engage each other to kind of renew that spirit? Because you seem to both want to live the fullness of your vocations. From what you've said.
Yeah. We just goof a lot. Like, mm-hmm. I'm trying to frame this.
Goof a lot. That's the first.
A lot of things of getting through this show, especially the ugly parts, is to laugh at it. Like, I listen to a lot of comedians' podcasts.
Sure.
And I think that there's a lot to be respected about comedians, because they're taking the truly horrific things that we all have to see and deal with in life. And what did my mentor said, you know, you can, life, you can either laugh or cry about something. And, you know, I've done enough crying, so I'm just going to laugh now. Right.
And sometimes you have to do the one you haven't done. If you're always laughing, then you got to cry. And if you're always crying, you need to laugh.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's the balance or the wholeness. Yeah.
So we definitely goof on things a lot, and there's a lot of inside jokes.
Sure.
And we're like nudging each other and giggle. We don't even have to say things often now. We just look at each other and go, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. It's that, the knowing look.
Right. And it sounds like you both enjoy playing.
Oh, God.
When you describe in yourself in the woods or stuff, I just have this sense of a kid playing.
Yeah. I don't take things very seriously. I'm very serious about that, though.
Right.
Yeah. But yeah.
You protect your time for that, your space for that.
Yeah, it's I'm sorry, I'm just giggling here because I just know the feeling, and there's not really words to put on it. It's just we kind of just tool along and giggle a lot. I don't know how else to say it. It's really what we do.
No, I sense it, and I think the listener can too. Ed, it has been wonderful getting to know you.
Thank you so much for having me, and I appreciate getting the chance to talk and get soggy-eyed and share my crazy, crazy story.
I wish you well. We're going to close with a Flogging Molly piece, If I Ever Leave This World Alive. Do you want to say anything about it?
No, I think that's pretty self-explanatory. please come to see us at the Finger Lakes Pottery Tour. It'll be a lot of fun.
And that's May 11 and 12.
Yes, indeed. Thank you.
Before you ever leave this world alive, well, thank you for the things you did in my life. If I ever leave this world alive, I'll come back down and sit beside your feet tonight. Wherever I am, you'll always be more than just a memory. If I ever leave this world sadness that I left behind. If I ever leave this world alive, the madness that you feel will soon subside. So in a word, don't shed a tear. I'll be here when it all gets weird. I'm okay.